Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is making it easy to get vaccinated. Care is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. Care is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Visit kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Well, apparently.
All right, welcome everyone. I want to welcome Oscar Munoz, who's joining us. Now, this one, Oscar, we've been trying to make this happen for quite a while. Your story is, I just can't begin to fathom the story arc to your journey. I mean, an undocumented immigrant becomes one of America's most successful and self-made CEOs. That's the American dream. And I'd love to have guests on like you that have actually come from very little and then risen to such a level through hard work. And if we can get just one or two or three nuggets from you that people can implement into their own lives, then hey, that's a success. So Oscar, welcome.
Well, thanks for having me and congrats on your success with your new business ventures, but more importantly, thank you for your service. It's quite the not just the service, but Team Six, and that's impressive. Okay, it's all of us. Congrats on that.
Thank you. With regards to the business, talk to me in 10 years. I'll let you know how it's going. I'm very much, as we call, a new guy. I think the only thing working in my favor is a sense of urgency and work ethic. So I'm just not going to quit. But for the listeners, please, from the very start, I'd love to know about your family and the journey into the United States. Particularly, it sounds like you guys settled down in Southern California, which is my home state. But give us the entire background with what you're comfortable with.
Sure. Not unlike a lot of people, and I've never really spoken about it until I wrote this book. Just because it just wasn't evident. I didn't want to have that, oh, gee, look at me. I need something extra or special. But the simple story is I was born my mom was a single mom. After I was born, she had the opportunity. My uncle had already come to the United States. This is in the area of Juarez, which is south of the border of El Paso. So she had an opportunity. My uncle had already been here, got all her papers aligned in the right fashion. So she went out to try to make a life, left me with my maternal grandmother, who I spent probably the first 8 years of my life. And we roamed around that northern part of Mexico between family and friends. We didn't have our own home, but we were not homeless. Anybody understands the Mexican community and the concept of familia or family? You're never without anything because you have all this. So a lot of my latent and dormant values about life and struggles and difficulties that we complain about, I put them in context with what she went through in her early life and what her and I went through together. And I always comment of my worst day at work is probably a good day for her. She was a maid, ended up being a maid at the Flamingo Hotel in Las Vegas in her later years. So it's just a story of the people that raised you, the impact they have upon you, I think is a big part of my story because she was never complained, never blamed anyone. Hard work. If something wasn't getting, she just worked harder, and she's always that. And that, a lot of great stories in the book about the recognition she received almost posthumously, but the latent values that it had for me. So I spent those years traveling. My mom got settled, and then the undocumented part was back in those days. You could just drive across the border. It wasn't a lot of things back in the day, so I didn't mean to be undocumented, person. It's just my mom and, importantly, her new husband, who I never met, and her two new kids. So she had another family that I got dropped into. And for all of us, we can understand if we met somebody, married someone, and then all of a sudden learn, wait, you have a child. It's 8 years old. And it's not in this country. So that was an uncomfortable situation for a little while. My new father, who became, I referred to him as my dad, because I never knew my real dad. Those early years were rough because, you know, most guys, and certainly Latino guys, it's just the concept of that was not good. And so I was a little bit of an outsider in that home. And with all the requisite, physical aspects that comes out to, he was not easy or very nice to me for a long period of time. Mm-hmm. Drove across with my uncle and, began to work on my sort of documentation. But then that's how we came over and started going to school and, learned the language. And I had enough aptitude over the course of time to have somebody sort of lead me into the direction of going to college. I went to college, which opened up a whole new world of things. And from that on, the story, builds on itself.
You know, people talk about the American dream. And I even say that all the time. Hey, that's the American dream. Exactly. Your story is exactly the American dream. But I was born in the United States. I mean, our family came in 1899 and we stayed in the San Francisco area. But, people say we got this border crisis. I mean, these are just people seeking opportunity. And there's something beautiful about that. I know there's a lot of policy that has to be put in place. But do you think a lot of us who were born here just, and I don't want to paint you into a corner, take some of the entitlements that we have for granted?
You know, I'm not one to cast what I would term as aspersions. Mm-hmm. I do think that we, especially increasingly more nowadays, we tend to listen to certain channels of information. Mm-hmm. And it's what fuels that ardor. I have a very close friend who's a cardiovascular surgeon and just always goes off about the border and the crisis and these illegal aliens are taking up our job. And he's so angry. His name is Bob. We'll call him Bob. How's that? It's like, you realize that I'm one of those immigrants. And I also don't know how many of those people trying to make a better life for themselves are taking your job as a cardiologist surgeon. So there's that hyperventilated sort of media noise that comes on both sides. It's not just one side or the other, because we should have some structure about how we let people across the border. There should be some measure. But again, we should also look at the realization that in this nation, the jobs that we have, a lot of Americans that were grown up and don't want to do them anymore, yet need to be done. And so is that a consideration? But we've chosen to go to our respective sides and just say F you to each other and then just make this a big political battle, yet nothing gets done. And so we have crisis. And then where I do get involved is when you start separating kids from their parents. And that kind of stuff is just, that's just not nonsensical. And, I've taken stances on certain things for those kinds of reasons.
You know what we call that? Just be a freaking human. As a human, would you separate parents from their children? The answer is no.
What part of that doesn't make sense to anyone, no matter who you are? So those kind of things. So yeah, it's. I don't think people are entitled. They just don't have. They don't have
the right perspective.
A perspective, and seek it. It's like learn. Just you hear one thing, go to it. I always tell people, look at the source of your information. There's these great charts online. They're media bias charts. So there's a chart that basically says from crazy lunatic fringe to, thoughtful sort of middle of the road thing. Whatever you read, don't just take the headline and start running around your circle. Did you hear that taking the vaccine is going to make you grow 5 eyes? And it's like, I read it. But you look at where the source is and you look at all these publications on both sides. So just know what your information is. And then importantly, I say, form your own freaking opinion.
Yeah.
Why is it that you have to listen to her? What do you think is it? That's the human sort of test, if you will.
Well, that's the whole point of education, is to develop critical thinking and allow people to have opposing opinions and engage in debate. But I do want to avoid, I will say this, you sound like a centrist, I'm a centrist. When people ask what that is, I said, we like to solve problems. I think this issue with the border is of our own doing. This has to go to NAFTA and everything else. This was avoidable in focusing on the wrong areas of the world when we should have been focusing here on the United States and the North American continent to make the general area better. But I will tell you, we've got, and I'm going to brag on her. I love it. We just helped her form her own company alongside two partners. But she is a first-generation American. Her mom came across the Rio Grande when she was pregnant with her. And this young woman, just the work ethic and just the character are amazing. And I cannot wait 20 years from now to watch what she does. I mean, she's doing it every day. But so you were the first of 10, well, the eldest of 10 children within the familia and first one in your family to attend college. Was I've got to ask, financially, were there scholarships or were you working day and night on top of studying?
No, I was very fortunate. Again, people come into your life to help you. And while in high school, because of the environment, my dad was a meat cutter, a union meat cutter. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. Nobody in our you know community, certainly in my family, had ever gone to college. And Mrs. Duckworth, a high school counselor, caught me in the hallway between classes one day and like, come over here. And I'm like, I'm in trouble again. And her question was, hey, I don't know you. I saw some of your test scores. You know, where are you thinking of going to college? And my answer was, as long as I said, what's a college? And then she started laughing off, like, no, I don't know what you're talking about. And so she took it upon herself, and I learned later, many others, not just me, to sort of help them understand that this avenue was potentially open. Now, that's the first part. The second part is, to your point, the economic aspect is like, what does this mean? And what do you mean I have to go somewhere and travel? And how would I, who's going to pay for all of this? And so she helped me understand back in the day how scholarships work. And I was very fortunate to the various schools that I got to have full ride scholarships for tuition and books. I still, to your question, I went hungry. I slept on floors and couches. I'm trying to remember when the first time I actually paid for a place to live for me personally. It was probably not to my junior year. I just met some incredible people that are lifelong friends to this day who, just young, knuckleheads. So I just hung out on couches and it was just one of those things because I couldn't afford it basically. So yeah, it was a lot.
Wow. Of work. Yeah. So you were basically transient for your freshman and sophomore year.
Yeah. I would.
My God.
And my dad was, again, just a classic story. I told you the early story about how he and I came together and wasn't his son, didn't want to acknowledge it. But when I had this opportunity to go to this thing called college, when I was leaving for work and I had a choice of many different colleges, thankfully, and I chose one just because it was close by, University of Southern California, USC. When I was leaving, he gave me a check for $142. And he said, I don't really know where you're going or what you're going to be doing. Here's something to help. It always makes me a little choked up just because you have to know me. Hard ass. I was not his favorite. I was not. But over time, he had softened the point. And just sending that message was great. And he gave me the keys to a piece of shit car, pretty much. But it was transportation. I was embarrassed. I would park it kind of way off, and then go back there and take clothes out and all that sort of stuff, and then drive off so nobody would see me. But yeah, so all those things. But again, you think about it, like, oh my God, that's such what a dramatic story. It wasn't really dramatic. I was going to college. I was enjoying. I made a ton of best friends that I have to this very day. Back to the concept of American Dream. It opened up an avenue for me that I would never have opened. But it wasn't easy and it wasn't handed to me. And people are like to say, well, you got handed all this stuff. It's like,
not at all.
The scholarship I got was earned on merit. They just don't give, it wasn't a, gee, let's give this to some poor Latino kid. It was on merit on my scores and my ability. And then, of course, the other stuff I had to work on my own. And that's how I worked it. It's just one way or the other. I made it work.
What did you major in?
I started, so all my aptitude tests said I should be a doctor. So I spent my first 2 years in the pre-med program. And I went, the summer of my sophomore year, I went to work at USC County Medical, which is the era between the Barrio and Watts. So when you want to talk about, I mean, it doesn't even compare to the stuff that you've seen in your life and your background, but, you know, a war zone comment, that hospital was the recipient of all of that. And in that summer, and I got to see all of that just being an intern there. And the doctor said, and it's like, the aptitude is not an issue. He's like, one of the things you're going to have to learn if you're going to become a medical professional is you're going to have to learn to not care about human life because you're going to lose people all the time. And if it carries it, it's going to drive you bats. And that was really impactful on me. It's like, you know, I don't know that I cannot care. It was just difficult to see people of my heritage, right, coming in maimed and tortured, drunk guys with a woman who's pregnant with a baby. I mean, just all of these visuals that, and worse. And I would never not care. So I went back and, you know, I transferred to the business school, which a lot of my parents transferred. And then I decided to go to law school because, you know, a doctor and lawyer sounds better than what a business person is, because I didn't know exactly what that meant, actually. So it was business at the end of the day.
It was business at the end of the day. And yeah. I know you got your MBA from Pepperdine. You said you got your law degree as well?
No.
Okay.
I quickly, that was another situation where I did not have a scholarship, and you cannot borrow books and borrow people's couches in law school first year. So I deferred. Then I would come back a year. I went back to get a job, got a job at Pepsi as a financial analyst, and never looked back.
Now, is this, I've always heard the PepsiCo of old had amazing sort of leadership development programs. Was that back in the day, or they put you right in the job?
It's funny, their leadership development was more trial by fire. It was intense. The conversation that a senior HR person came, so there's three of us hired out of some 200 people. It was like this, they made it so painful. So you finally get selected for this role. And then the three amigos, as we call it, we hung out every day, went out on weekends, went to lunch. And, you know, we spent 3 months kind of getting, you know, got a job. And somebody comes from New York one day. This is in Southern California, in Torrance. And Sean, Don, and myself, those are three guys. This guy pulls us over at dinner and goes, hey, this is how it works at Pepsi. The three of you work for this one person. He's either going to move up in a year to 18 months, or he's going to be gone. And one of you will ascend to his position. The other of you will be fired. And the third of you will give another year to find the right place. Thank you very much. Gotta go. okay. So leadership development program, it's like you quickly had a sense of the need to survive. So I was fortunate to be the one that ascended. And one of the people that was in that initial list is still, and he may have retired by now, but he's been with the company the whole time. And the third person was left and is doing his own thing and succeeding somewhere else, I'm sure.
That is, I guess sometimes it is better to be feared than loved, according to PepsiCo. It can be a great driver of many things. After PepsiCo, you took a break and then went back and got your MBA at Pepperdine, correct?
So Pepsi, back to the leadership program, you needed to learn to think on your feet. It was very intense. So it was very much a learning ground. So then I got admitted to Pepperdine and I was going to go in the night program. I was poor, so I really couldn't take the time off to go to any other school. So they paid for the program. But midway through my MBA is when Coke kept calling. So I switched to Coke in the middle of the process.
Yes.
So I went at night, and it was a satellite school. So everybody's like, ooh, Pepperdine, what a great, beautiful place. Yeah, I saw it twice.
I thought you actually went to Pepperdine. Pepperdine is one of the most beautiful campuses on the coast. Yeah. Wait. When you switched from PepsiCo to Coca-Cola, I mean, were you literally shown out the door with disgust?
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't so much disgust, just because I had enough of a relationship with people, but it was the process. So having knowing that would happen the night before I announced, I had gone into my office and taken all my personal stuff. So the whole concept of walking out with a box just seemed like not something I wanted to do. So I understood. I said, hey, listen, I understand. I'm walking out the door as we speak, and we had one of the longest going away parties because it started at lunch and. I don't remember, but it was the wee hours of the morning at the time we finally got home. So we had a nice celebration, and it was a great time there. I learned a lot. But the Pepsi, the Coke job was probably 2 to 3 levels above where I was. So it was the right thing for me to do at the time. So it was a really big move. I went from, you know, in essence, a manager to kind of a managing director kind of role. So I took a pretty big jump in responsibilities.
Okay. So I think that that's a great point to sort of reflect on here. And I'd love to get your opinion. So first, you've now are stepping into a position 2 or 3 levels above where you have. Did you feel prepared? Did you feel behind the curve? How did you, if you did feel that you weren't totally prepared, how did you sort of deal with the pressures of performing in that position?
It's a great insight because, and I, it's funny, I write about this in the book because mm-hmm. it's so critical. So how did I go? Well, I am 26 years old at the time, taking a role that's probably 4 years, anyone near my level, there's no one within my age group. There's everybody's 5 to 10 years older. I'm coming from Pepsi, like I felt, and then Coke. Coke was, if you think of the Atlanta, the city, and New York, the city, and all the travel, very different places, right? More genteel and slow, New York being the frenetic place that it is. The cultures of the two companies were different. So I'm coming from these, what I would call shark-infested waters. You see the competitiveness, the thrust that you have in it. And I walk into this, you know, it was a local bottler. It wasn't owned by corporate. The people around me were significantly more senior. And so the young whippersnapper in me sort of sensed the world where it's like, okay, these people are dinosaurs, right? I'm like, this is that coolest person. It's like, you know, Pepsi, you didn't see a lot of people that were older because it was just literally up and out for that place. So the learning that I had was I went in kind of cocky and arrogant. I call it all asses and elbows, right? Like, hey, you guys clearly haven't done much in your career because you're still doing the same damn things. It was that very wrong mentality. And I had great coaching from my boss at the time. And again, the importance of people in your life that care enough about you to share and course correct is a really important thing to nurture. But he said the famous words to me. He's like, you know what? You're doing great, Oscar. We took a chance on you at your relative age. You've done great. You're crushing it. And if there's only one advice I would give you, and he's like, you're not yet as good as you think you are. Mm. And I remember thinking, it's like, wait, what the hell does that mean? That doesn't sound funny. And what he was saying is like, dude, slow your roll. I mean, yeah. It's like, and then you quickly begin, I quickly begin to see those people around me that I thought of, quote, dinosaurs. And mm-hmm. he said, you know, it's like, I remember this one more in particular, Pat Walker's, again, brilliantly, Harvard MBA. Now, 20 years earlier, sir, but my ass didn't have a Harvard MBA. I didn't have it. And so when I got to meet with her and talk, and you listen and learn from people, it's a meaningful thing. So yeah, I went in cocky, and one of the first big lessons of my life was to listen and learn before you go, you know, leading and spotting your mouth up.
There's a lot of people that need to take that advice. I'll tell you, as a leader, I would rather tell somebody to slow their roll. I would see that as a positive thing. They've got a sense for urgency. They're driven, than having to coax somebody into taking action. Cause I'm not a believer that you can, let me say this. It's harder to create drive where there is none. But it's easier to slow somebody down. Do you feel you're a product? And I know you talked about your grandmother and your familia. Do you feel you're a product of a lot of the business leaders you served for within PepsiCo, Coke? I know eventually US West and CSX.
You know, we are. You know, I think Tennyson said it in his one of his poems. We are all parts of people we've met along the way. I'm paraphrasing. I certainly consider myself parts of all the people around me, good and bad. I don't know that there's one or two people in my history that I would say, oh my God, I think my grandmother and those early the values that she instilled in me, latent as they were to come out, was probably the most significant. Everyone else had good and bad. And I think one of the things that we learned going up, it's like, listen, I know how that made me feel when you said that, good or bad, right? I mean, the military is a great example. It's like, what is that sandwich thing where it's like, always deal with something bad. It's like, hey, those headphones are good. And then they just thrash you about the stuff. And it's like, yeah, and you know, your watch is nice too or something.
The compliment just, sandwich. Yeah, that's how most people run evaluations, which I leave the room thinking, hey, I'm kicking ass. Yeah.
And so I have learned a lot from the people over the course of time. But the most important lesson I've learned from people around me is that, you know, if you allow yourself, or you allow people around you to be able to share with you, you give them, you make them trust you enough that it's okay for them to say, you know, Oscar, that's not a very good idea. That's a really meaningful thing. And it's tough to do for us because as leaders, especially for me, not only being young, but being Latino in a world of high finance where that wasn't necessarily the place that people like me were seeing, it made you kind of over-index and trying to be overly serious. And that was literally crushing my soul for a while. I was just trying way too hard. And so I learned the concept of swing easy, which is just, again, like, you know, you can't be everything to everyone. You know, you do belong here, but that burden of perfection on someone of my age and my heritage was a difficult thing to manage and work through.
Humbling. So for the listeners, you eventually, again, go to US West and eventually take the CFO role at CSX. I mean, you were at CSX a long time, eventually taking the chief operating role and eventually the CEO for a very short period of time. CSX must have just loved the organization and the culture, I'm assuming.
Well, you know, it was my first C-suite job at a relatively young age. So the learning of being part of a large public company that was in an old industry, it's a railroad.
Yes.
And railroads have been around for a few hundred years. It was completely insiders. No one really from the outside went in. Like, who would want to go into a railroad, right? I mean, I was working at AT&T and telecom, and I had a job at American Express heading my way. But I saw the value from a financial perspective of, gosh, you know, if we could just get this business top line growing, at the market cap was $7 billion, which is nothing. I think it's at 70 today, probably 55 or 60 when I left. So we created a ton of value in that space. But yeah, it was a great year. I was part of a wonderful team. We did so many things. My boss allowed me to do so much of the things that I knew from other companies to change the views there. And we had a great, great run there.
I know eventually in 2015, you were on the board for United Airlines. Eventually they offered the CEO spot to you. Prior to stepping into that, it sounds like you've already solidified your leadership style, not formulaic, but some sort of approach to how you lead. And it's very people-centric from what I got from the book. We used to have a mantra, mission first, people always. I'm assuming within CSX, it was those formative years that you sort of solidified your leadership style.
Yeah, and it was less as a support function as the head of finance and technology and all those other functions that I had. But even then, I learned to, when you're dealing with the head of operations, and he always, you know, they always want more. It's like, no, you can't. And I would always try to work with him. It's like, help me understand why you need more. And let me figure out trying to make things simple for people. Like, listen, you come to me for money because you think I hold the money or I'm holding it back. It isn't my money. It's the investor's money. If you walked into a bank and you said, hey, I got an idea for a business, you know, can you give me $10 million? They're going to say, well, yeah, let's look at your business plan. They want to know how you're going to get repaid. It's no different inside a corporation. Mm-hmm. So I would always try to teach my teams to listen about those things and how do you help operational folks. But even then, it was a struggle because I was a finance person. When I became COO, this is a great story. about a year in, I needed more locomotives. Locomotives are the heart blood of a railroad, as airplanes are to an airline, right? Simple. Well, my predecessor would always ask for more locomotives. They're expensive. And he said, we need 100 locomotives per year. That was his operational sense. And I would say, help me put that into numbers so I can enforce the benefit. And fast forward, I'm in the job 2 years. We're running short of locomotives. I'm like, I need locomotives. And it's like, and the finance guy at the time, who was somebody I put in the job, it's like, yeah, but you got to, and it's like, ah. And it's like, I should have done it earlier and I wouldn't be facing this issue. I always tell that story for us because, you know, unless you do it, unless you're operating something day in and day out, you understand that the structure and finance and legal and all stuff, important stuff. But as much as you can make it manageable for the person that has so many things that they're doing, And you know, a financial thing is just one more thing. How do you help them rather than be the structure that says no all the time? And so I learned a lot from that process. And so, yeah, my leadership style began to get established there, especially in connecting with frontline personnel, union personnel, in a world of a distributed workforce where it wasn't a factory floor, but, you know, very much like an airline, it's a network business where, you know, you have a locomotive engineer and a conductor. That's two people on a train, and you never see them in large masses. So I began this concept of listening to people and getting out to them rather than being this imperial nature that stood afar from them.
So you step into the CEO role of CSX, and very shortly after that, you take the role of United Airlines. For me, describe the disposition of United Airlines when you stepped into that role.
Yeah. So just a quick correction. My last role at CSX was COO. So I was there.
COO.
I was about to be, the announcement for me to become CEO was literally 6 weeks later. And it was going to be announced that I would be the CEO by the end of the year. And this was late in the year. So the state of the business at United was broken. They had an attempted merger, an ongoing merger with Continental, where I was on the board. Had not been going well for a bunch of different reasons. Business was failing. Customers were upset. We didn't have any operational things. The financial numbers were awful. Customer sentiment was below. So it was just not a broke. It was a broken place. And then my predecessor there got into a little bit of trouble with some legal issues, and so he had to step away from the role. And I was invited to join.
So everything is relative, given the amount of C-suite experience you had stepping in, could be comparable to a young manager stepping into a bad situation. For them, give us your framework of, you know, you're inheriting this problem. And the second you step into that office and take the role, the buck now stops there with you. Did you go in with a blank slate? Hey, let me just figure this out for 30, 60 days. Or did you have sort of a methodology you were going to step in with and try to solve that problem?
Yeah. You always have your experience. Mm-hmm. The CEO role is an incredibly different animal than a COO role or a CFO role because of what you just mentioned. There's the buck stops here. Right? It's like, okay, there's no one that you don't have a boss. Your board is around, but it's your decision. And so that concept was a little daunting for sure. I've talked to you about, I never walk into a situation all asses and elbows. I wanted to truly listen and learn because the place was broken. The sort of the leadership principles that I probably walked into is that, having done a turnaround at United and a couple other smaller places, I know that the best way to start is to start with the right thing and figuring out what that right first thing is. Now, everything is broken, and you'll have many people telling you, oh, you got to fix this and you got to fix that. And none of that will be, everything will be different. So figuring out what that is. And when I walked around visiting all the locations, I could sense, I don't know what it was, a sense of this human, like a save me concept. Like everybody smiled and took pictures, but it's just this lingering of, you know, somebody stayed on your coat a little longer, held your handshake just a bit. It was like, and overall smiling and overall putting a good face, but it's kind of like Stepford Wives or something. There was something amiss. And I think what sometimes we fail to do is look for those small nuances of something's not right here. And so my instinct told me it's what I had done at CSX. So there was some former. It's like, you know what? I'm just going to go out and talk to people. And in essence, hey, if things are broken, what do you think? And it's like, well, what are you going to glean from that? I mean, these people don't really understand strategy and business and all that stuff. No, but they understand how this business runs and how customers feel. And so I announced that I would be on this listening tour. And it turned out to be one of the most, you know, insightful and intelligent things that I did because, I didn't get any specific. I did get the sense that we could not do anything strategically. The platform, the one thing we had to start first is regain the trust of our employees, not our customers, not our investors, but the employees themselves. They had 8 CEOs in the previous 10 years. So, you know, the flip-flop strategy direction and people, you know, spouting off different things. We're going to be this and we're going to be that. You know, when you're at that level, you just come in and work for a living. It's like, listen, you're not making any sense to me. And there's nothing I'm going to say. So I made it an effort to go down at those lower levels day and night to really listen to them. And what I, you know, what I came away was this issue is like, wow, they are upset, they are angry, and there's nothing we're going to say strategically that's going to make any sense to them because it doesn't include them. This listening tour, what in effect happened was they became part of the solution. Now, of course, I didn't talk to 84,000 people. Of course, I couldn't. But you talk to one in a genuine way, and he or she tells 5 or 10 people, and they tell. And then all of a sudden, it became this wave of, hey, this guy's different. He's actually listening to us. And then later, when we announced that regaining the trust of our employees was going to be our first thrust, that is something they understood. It's like, wait, what? You're going to, what do I have to do? It's like, you don't have to do anything. You have to put your trust in a place where I can regain it, and it's my job to go get it. So you don't have to do anything. I have to prove it, not promise to you what we're going to do. And so that was the philosophy. So it evolved on basic principles, but the actual action takes place when you're out there and you get a sense of what needs to be fixed.
I love this sort of belief of breaking down that ivory tower effect, as I call it. And I've seen that so often with the C-suite that sits within their throne and never actually visits the thousands of employees that are running operations on the front lines. I mean, General Mattis was infamous for that. Despite his staff saying, sir, no, we need you here in the Joint Operations Center, he'd say, no, we're going to the front. I want to see what's going on. I want to talk to the Marines, the young Marines. So is it true you used a question, you posed a question to the people of what are the 10 dumbest things that our company does to help figure out the right path?
I did. And this wasn't the frontline people. This was my senior most team. This was the C-suite. I said, you know what we're going to do today? Because it's like, you know, it's like we're going to regain trust of folks. It's like I'm hearing so many things from all these people. It's like, and it's like, what do we think the 10 dumbest things are? And let's methodically just fix them. So very easy, very simply, respond to their needs. Like we recognize, you all know this is stupid. We just recognized it and we are attempting to fix it. That shows a lot, right? I call it proof, not just promise. And so the 10 dumbest things, I don't exactly know where I got that idea. How, but I just hear it so much. And I mean, the things that we were doing, some were more extreme and difficult to solve. Some were so simple that it was just, and again, that word got around. So it's like, okay, this is just a practical person who gets this and is free and willing to admit that this was a stupid thing and stop it and sort of reverse direction on that.
So ultimately, you orchestrated one of the greatest turnarounds in the airline industry ever. And it wasn't following sort of, let's call it the Harvard or Wall Street Journal sort of strategic approach that they would traditionally take. You said we're putting our people first rather than most business leaders saying we're putting our revenue first. What, you know, where do you think most leaders go wrong these days? I know there's pressure from, you know, the investors, from the stockholders. But you do see some companies dispense with people as if they're an itemized itemized, you know, thing that they can just dispense with easily. You don't have that approach.
Yeah, and it's a delicate balance for sure because you can't walk around and everything's nice, everybody's sweet, and and you know the business has to work, so you have to make tough decisions for sure. But again, I think we increasingly live in a world where we're attenuating ourselves from people, right? It's so easy to be hybrid and work. And it makes so this isolation, the ivory tower, as you dub it, it gets even easier because, you know, I'm not supposed to travel out there. So, it's hard for me to say writ large what leaders do or don't do. I don't believe a lot of them believe in the philosophy of listening and learning first. And a lot of it is people that reach a level are pretty intelligent people, sometimes highly intelligent. And your brain says, you know, that's not a good use of the mathematics, the use of your time, with your intellect, figuring out strategic things. And, you know, spending time with people who, you know, it's going to just take a lot of time. It doesn't compute to some degree. And I think I think that's kind of a little bit of the problem. And what they have to understand is that the computation isn't linear. The value is exponential. And when you talk with the humans that are actually involved and the value that you get from that. And so I don't think people believe that it's worth the time or it takes too much, or I'm going to set the false expectations. Gosh, if I talk to everybody, they're all going to have different opinions. And I simply say, it's like, you don't have to promise them. You have a conversation with an individual and he or she tells you something. You just listening makes all the difference. And then you say, listen, thank you for your input. This is all going into the hopper.
Yes.
And it's going to be part of decisions. And your particular thing, Mayor, you don't promise that you're going to fix everything. You just promise that listening and putting your thoughts into this thing are going to make sense. And so there are practical ways to get a lot of those things, but you also have to be genuine about it. So somebody may say, okay, yeah. I'm going to go do that. But then you go out there. So Mattis was effective because when he was out there, he knew he wanted to be out there, right? It wasn't like it was a checklist. A lot of people, where they go wrong, this is a place where people go wrong. It's a check. Okay, well, we're going to go visit 7 facilities in the next 4 months.
Yeah.
And then you fly in, there's 1,000 people and cameras and recording. Look at me, I'm with the people. And the people are like, right. Human dynamics are so simple. We respect and trust in people that we think genuinely care about us. And when it's that fake thing, it's like, you know what, you're wasting your time. So I think that's an area where people probably go wrong a little bit.
People don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And I know we've all heard that line. How did you balance personally the belief, and I'm with you, you know, your human capital, it may not be on the balance sheet, but it's there. It's there. How do you balance the importance of people with maintaining standards? Because I see some people get that wrong. And I've seen, you know, I'm blanking on her name, but the former chief talent officer of Netflix, it'll come, Patty McCord, talked about how they viewed letting somebody go from a business as a service to them to allow them the time to go find a culture where they truly fit. But how do you balance, again, between people and sort of instructing that, yes, we believe in people, but you have to contribute and you have to maintain a standard that we set within the company?
The standards for senior leaders are just different. It's not that hard mm-hmm. to make a tough decision with those senior leaders. Because I have a much more an affinity to make the right decision at the senior level for a host of different things. Capability, work ethic, going with the flow, working with the team, aligning, you know, all those different factors. And it's relatively easy to make those. When someone isn't there, they quickly know that they're not fitting. And so almost everyone I've always let go has always been a relatively amicable thing.
Yes.
One key person says, hey, you know, Alaska, I get it. This is in Chicago, you know, the sports analogy. Because, you know, I'm from the 85 Bears era, and you're more of a West Coast offense, and that doesn't fit me. I get it. You know, we'll see you later kind of thing. So at that level, it's really a little bit easier, if you will.
Yes.
It's at the lower levels that I have a much higher standard, because a lot of those people, whatever they're doing, usually they're not doing right, is because they've never been told or taught how to do it any other way. And so before we just universally dismiss these folks, has anyone ever actually talked to them? Because they probably learned whatever they're doing from their predecessor, who learned from their predecessor, and it's just, that's what I was taught to do, this is how I do it. You know, don't trust people, don't let them go, they're trying to screw you, where that's not necessarily the case. So that you can teach. So at United, we went through a very difficult, time-consuming, and somewhat costly to teach our frontline supervisors the concept of caring for their employees in a way that made them successful. It never said, you can't let go of people. Now we have a union, so there's all sorts of processes. But, you know, the value of bringing people along willingly is such a more valuable and durable leadership sort of outcome than forcing or putting fear. And that's always been my philosophy. And so you go through a lot of efforts to teach and counsel folks. But again, for me, the standard for dismissal was infinitely higher the lower you went in the organization.
I know you're also a believer in communication, and that's one of the soft skills, the attributes that a senior leader, that any great leader must master. And it's been even further complicated with the, you know, advent of social media and managing crises. How did you go about, one, sort of developing that skill for yourself, but two, for the leaders underneath you?
There's an organization that I was sent to a long time ago as a youngster was basically kind of a public speaking class. And what the benefit of it from us at an early age was how nervous you saw other people, so you weren't alone. Two, the skills they taught you were very simple, but the most poignant and memorable thing for me was seeing myself on the video and cringing. It's like, oh my God, I do that? I look like that when I say that? I sound like, right? You have this internal shame. And what you attribute it to, it's like, okay, so as you are reflecting and you know, commenting on yourself, think of what the people you interact with every day. That's what they see. And so for me, that was very meaningful. And I have sent probably thousands of people over the course of my career to this firm to do this, because it's just been such a critical sort of life-changing beyond the technical skills of how to talk and direct and look at people and all that, which is important, and more that reflective things like, wow, that's how I come across to people and how I want to change that. And it just builds confidence, right? The ability to communicate openly and effectively is not a common trait, but for people that do it, they usually do it because they're comfortable in doing it. And that's all you have to learn. When you come structure and you're like, this, and I'm talking to you, it's like, well, you're a question, and yeah. I'm reading it.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah. there's a better way of doing that. So I think communication is key, and it's an ever, never, ever, ever, ever ending thing. And in particular, in points of crisis, you know, one thing we haven't spoken about, I had a horrible failure in a situation with a passenger being beaten and dragged off an aircraft. And
yes.
Back to communication, the first response built upon lawyers and risk managers and working the concept on my initial public response was utter ridiculous and fear. Two or three days later, I'm going live on TV, again, getting the same level of coaching, and my instinct, the latent values from my grandmother, actually, it's like, she would never blame someone else. And I just said, you know what? It was me. I let policies where she just get in the way of doing the right thing for another human being that she and we ended that chapter, but boy, was that a key learning about how to communicate better.
So I remember that vividly, and it was on the news. We remember the first response, and what I call, you broke ranks. You said, hey, I appreciate the strategic advice from all of you. I'm doing this my way, which you knew was the professional way to demonstrate accountability for, as we discussed, the buck stops here. And you did it masterfully. What I didn't get to, but I do want to end with this.
Oh, yeah, that.
So 37 days into the role, you have a major heart attack, which eventually requires a heart transplant. So I know the stress of working at a company like CSX as COO for years and being on the boards. Do you think you ignored your health at sometimes, diet, getting out there and working out?
You know, interestingly, so I'll give the broader PSA on this, because I think it's very important. And, you know, you have a largely male audience, and we guys are probably the worst. Heart conditions and heart issues, heart failure, is the biggest killer in America by far. I mean, cancer ain't got nothing on heart disease. And mostly because the symptoms for heart disease are many and varied. There is no, oh my God, I've got the big one and it hurts. It manifests itself in so many different ways. And so we, especially as guys, tend to blow it off. You know, we go for a workout, whatever, something doesn't feel right, we feel kind of, we jump in the shower or lay down for a second, you never get up. That's a cold, hard fact. Mm. And I fortunately had a friend who's a cardiovascular surgeon, actually, who'd always talked to us about how, hey, listen, if you ever feel anything weird, just call 911. You know, the worst you can be is embarrassed that it was indigestion, but the best thing to do is, so when I had symptoms that I had just gone on a run and my phone buzzed, I went to walk, my legs kind of felt wobbly and I was clammy. Those are my two symptoms. I remembered his views. And he said, call 911 immediately, tell them where you are. And he goes, and tell them that immediately because you may not make it past the phone call. And I remember that being dramatic. But when I got on that phone, I immediately said, here's where I am. Come get me. And it ended up being a massive heart attack that should have killed me. But because I called so quickly, I was taken care of and eventually got a heart transplant.
But you didn't, from what I read, it's not like you took probably the downtime you should have taken because you were doing interviews while hooked up to, was it a dialysis machine to keep the, what was it? No,
it was an ECMO.
ECMO. Thank you. Yeah, but you were doing interviews for senior management positions shortly after the transplant.
I ended up having an LVAD, which is a device that artificially pumps your heart. My old heart had blown up. And so that we needed to replace it. I wasn't quite ready mentally to accept that I couldn't fix it myself. Again, another male trait. Like, no, I got this. Yeah. I figured this out.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I was an avid biker. I'd been run marathons. I was a vegan for ridiculous reasons. But nevertheless, the concept was that when I kind of got past it, again, mind over matter. I mean, it's amazing how a healthy personal attitude about things and how I felt about this company and these people kind of kept me going through that whole thing. So I was like, put me in, coach, let's go. Now, it would take a while for me to get physically ready to be seen because I looked like hell. Mm-hmm. It was, Auschwitz-like kind of the feeling because it was brutal. But survived and competitively at that hospital, post-transplant, I got out. The only person to beat me from a time perspective was a 21-year-old kid. So I figure for my age group, I'm number one. So less than 7 days from transplant to being on a car, left on a Thursday, and I was in the office on Monday. Again, I don't brag about that just because, oh my God. But I felt, good enough to be able to do that.
Okay. But you've got to explain this to me. You're now an advocate of the flexitarian diet, which I have no freaking clue what that is.
I think it was simple from this. I had this vegan thing. The reason was my sister had cancer. And I figured as everybody was supporting her, a lot of people were shaving their head. And I figured I had more weight than hair to lose. So I went with the, I adopted her diet in a sense is why I was that way. But I had lost like 45, 50 pounds during that ECMO process. I had to learn how to walk again because all my muscle had frayed. And so my doctor said one day, you know what? Quit that bullshit. It's like, we can't feed you like that. I need you to eat 2 Chicago deep styles pizza for every meal. That's kind of how I want you to eat right now. I need to put some more of that. And so flexitarian term was basically eat whatever you want. Flexible, right? It's like
Do you put a higher precedence on your health today than you did prior to the heart attack, you think?
I think, again, before, I mean, I was an avid biker and runner.
Yes.
So for me, I never knew my father. So I don't know. It was genetics.
Congenital.
I mean, a lot of heart failure was genetics. And so I wasn't particularly heavy or anything. I have renewed emphasis on it. In fact, I've sponsored a lot of research on how does somebody with a new heart exercise, right? So we're still working. Not many people ask that question. How do you go back to work and how do you exercise after a transplant?
You look good. You look healthy. You look happy. You look good. I can't thank you enough for your time. For everyone listening, go purchase Turnaround Time. It's on Amazon. Funny enough with Amazon, I do want to get your views. Andy Jassy just came out. They revoked the remote work, and it's gone over like a lead balloon within Amazon. Where do you think we go with the desire for people to work remotely? Do you think it's here to stay? Do you think it's a hybrid model? It's industry dependent, role dependent. I know that's a huge debate right now for a lot of leaders trying to figure this out.
I think the most definitive thing you can say at this point is that a hybrid situation absolutely has to exist. I think it's a difference between what people don't understand at the lower levels, the importance of culture, the importance of interaction with other humans for you to advance your abilities and your capability of leadership. It's hard to do it this way. It just is. And I think senior leaders are beginning to realize the impact on the business there. So some are doing it more extreme, like get dressed back to work. Some are doing it more methodically and time-wise. But I think Mondays and Fridays in the office are banned forever.
Yeah.
I don't know how you bring that back. I don't know. I mean, and some people, banks have done that, and some industries as well. But I think a healthy balance is going to be good. But the time with each other, we are human. You know, our species needs that connection. It's just the way we're built. And without it, I just don't think you can thrive as well as you can, you know, sort of apart.
I came from an organization where team was literally in the title. It's part of our DNA. It's actually how I identify. But I mean, could you imagine trying to forge and create and collaborate and prepare a SEAL platoon for combat in a remote environment? I mean, so funny enough, if you remember Operation Eagle Claw, which was the failed attempt for the 52 American hostages, it was Delta Force's one of their first operations. The founder of Delta Force was a guy named Charlie Beckwith. When he testified in the investigations that ensued, he basically put it this way: Bear Bryant can't build a national championship team with his quarterback in Alabama, his offensive line in Texas, and his defensive line in Oklahoma. And it sort of summarizes that it kills that culture, that ability for human connection, you know, esprit de corps, emotional intimacy, especially collaboration and innovation. So it's going to be interesting to see where this settles out.
Sure will.
Okay. Well, guys, back to my point. We're finishing this out. Again, go pick up Turnaround Time. It's available on Amazon. This is a must read, and I'll put it to you this way. If you are stepping into any leadership role, small or large, and you know you're stepping into, let's say, a situation that's not the best, this is almost like a user's manual to approach that situation, to identify what needs to be done first. And Oscar Munoz, whose story is just, again, the American dream, the epitome of the American dream, orchestrated one of the largest turnarounds in the airline industry. Oscar, thank you for joining us. Best of luck with the book and your future endeavors, and let us know if we can ever be of assistance to you.
Terrific. Well, thank you. Thanks for having me. And thanks to all of you out there for listening.
All right, guys. Thanks. We'll see you again.
This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.